international bond finance, Eurobond law. We want to understand the nature, structure and operation of the Eurobond market. We've been looking at the loan market. We've understood the background to the Eurodollar system. The Eurodollar markets emerged in the early 1960s following the restoration of currency convertibility in 1958 after the Second World War. We have two key markets emerging. We have a loan market based on a loan document with a group or syndicate of banks. The other option for governments and companies is to issue bonds into the market directly in the form of a security. You can either enter into a loan agreement with a syndicate of banks, or you can enter bonds directly into the market. So we need to try and understand the structure, nature and operation of the euro bond market. So we're looking at loans and bonds, structures, parties and documentation, issue procedure, special issues, terms, and we'll draw some comments and conclusions. Chapter which explains all of the Eurobond law. We're looking at this in terms of market structure, bond structures, what are the key financial terms, amount, term, interest, form, parties, documentation, facility and additional provisions. We'll look at the nature of the procedure. How do you actually enter into one of these deals in practice? How do you prepare all of the documentation? How do you actually run, for example, a 100 million euro bond issue? So we'll look at all of the different stages in that. Mandate, launch date, documentation, terms, signing, dealing and stabilisation, allotment, trust deed, listing, closing, definitive bonds and global bonds and securities. We'll look at bond negotiability, we'll look at bond clearing, we'll look at euro bonds, and then other more specific types of bond markets, including UK gilts, stocks and bonds, US Treasury Agency municipal bond market, the Japanese government bond debenture market, German government bonds and debentures, other government securities, corporate bonds, foreign bonds and bond bearings. We can understand all of this from the bond chapter provided. This is one of the earliest bonds. This is Dutch East India Company, 1623. This was originally said in Old Dutch, but we've had it translated so we can understand this. This is a typical loan deal and a typical Eurobond offering. This is useful to explain the differences between the parties and the additional complexity that arises with the further documentation that we require in our bond structure. With an international commercial loan, you've got the borrower, usually the borrower and the borrower's group, they will enter into a loan agreement. We need three key sets of documents. We need a mandate letter, an information memorandum, and a loan agreement. The loan agreement will then provide for multiple drawdown. You'll have the borrower, the borrower's group, and then you'll have the syndicate of banks who make the funds available. In the typical example, we could refer to one borrower, nine subsidiary companies, that makes 10 borrowers, 10 banks in the syndicate, 100 million. In that example, what we've actually got is this: all of the separate loans, which are then drawn down, are governed by a single loan agreement, although legally each of these is separate and distinct. So we could have, for example, 10 borrowers, 10 banks, that's minimum 100. But there will be a facility A, will be the term loan for a fixed term, and then we'll also have a revolving facility that we can draw down, repay, draw down, repay. So at minimum, we will have 200. But there will also be an availability period that we can draw down under for both the A's and the B's. That might be 2 years, 3 years, 4 years. So we can have multiple drawdowns under both facilities. Very quickly, the number of drawdowns, the number of specific loans, will then run into the hundreds, if not thousands. There could be thousands and thousands of separate loans undertaken, taken out under the single facility, although they're governed by the same document, a single loan agreement. There's actually multiple legal facilities under that. We have to treat them all separate. And we saw that in the key language, the key clauses. This is all several, which provides that the syndicate members are not jointly and severally liable for each other's involvement. We will see it's joint and several liability when we look at the managers and the bondee. But what that means is one of the borrowers draw down, one of the banks cannot make up its facility. For example, if it becomes illegal for some reason, the other banks are not required to make up the difference. The agent bank will then go into the market and find an alternative party. So we have multiple drawdowns, multiple legal agreements, multiple loans, but governed by one single loan document. We have the borrower, the borrower's group, the lead or arranging bank sets up the facility, it brings all the parties together, it does all of the drafting, but then it leaves. It will leave on the closing, on the signing, it takes a very large fee, which will be a percentage of the transaction, and then effectively disappear. The loan is then managed by the agent bank for the duration of the facility, for example, 20 years. In the capital markets, we have a large number of additional parties. Therefore, the transaction becomes a lot more complex with a lot more documentation. We're effectively considering all of the key provisions. The same sets of measures that we would look at in the loan deal, it's just that we're now going to spread them around over all of these separate documents. So again, it adds an additional level of complexity. The three key sets of provisions always are the financials, basically amount, term, interest, payment, repayment. Obligations, the conditions precedent, the representations and warranties, and the continuing covenants, and then the defaults. A whole series of default provisions, and then you have default remedies, remedies on default. I've identified core sets of protections in the event of default, suspension or withholding of further advance, cancellation of obligation to lend under the facility, acceleration of repayment, rescission of the documentation, and then you sue for damages in contract or in tort. All of the same provisions are incorporated into the capital market documentation, although usually in a much more dilute form. This market has a distinct nature simply because the debt this time isn't recorded in the form of a single fixed loan agreement. It's expressed using securities. And all of these are then issued in a transferable and a negotiable form. So the debt isn't evidence constituted by the loan agreement and then the drawdowns under that. Each drawdown in this case will be evidenced by a separate bond certificate. These are transferable, which adds massive amounts of additional liquidity to the market. That's principally why borrowers who can use the capital markets can draw down more at cheaper rates, what we call a lower coupon. They don't have to pay as high an interest rate, they pay a lower coupon on the bonds, so they can borrow more at a cheaper rate, simply because of the additional liquidity in the bond market, because these are transferable and negotiable. Negotiability refers to the fact that we can transfer them with perfect title, so long as the acquirer does not have any notice of any defect in title. The history of the bond market is then one of shorter duration. While we had the emergence of both the loan market in the 1960s and the bond market, beginning in the 1960s, the first euro bond deal technically was the Autostrade deal to build the motorway system in North Italy. That was 1963, SG Warburg. The subsequent history of the market has then been one of shorter duration. We go from long 20-year bonds down to medium-term notes, 15, 10, 15-year notes, down to shorter euro notes, 1 to 5, Euro notes up to 7, although you can get Euro notes for less than 1, but generally if it's less than 1 year, we talk about commercial paper. 1 year commercial paper, 1 to 20 notes, 20 plus bonds. Strictly, legally, by definition, if it's got a fixed interest rate, it's a bond. If it's a floating rate, it's a note. So the history is then one of shorter duration instruments. And then we can see how all of this works by understanding all of the parties and then the documentation that sets out the rights, duties and obligations of all of the parties concerned. How can we summarise these new instruments, in particular the short-term notes that we're issuing? Let me identify, I think there's like 4 or 5 key descriptors we can use having regards to all of these. They are basically essentially all short-dated, bearer, negotiable, unsecured, deposited, promissory notes. They may either be listed or unlisted, and they may be committed or uncommitted. They're all short-dated. They're bearer. Title is not evidenced by the register held by the issuer. Possession confirms ownership. They're bearer instruments. They're negotiable. They're not just transferable. You can acquire perfect title. This is recognised in the case law to be a negotiable instrument. This must be recognised by the market, and then the market must be recognised by the courts. And there's a series of important case law in this area, which is all set out in the chapter, which confirms this. You look at the market, you look at the market history, it's usually expressed in terms of volume and frequency. Because of the volume and frequency of transactions in the market, do the merchants recognise this as being negotiable, in which case the courts will not question it, and the courts will recognise that negotiability. They're unsecured. Usually in this market, everything is unsecured. It's a professional wholesale market, unsecured. Fifthly, I said deposited. Usually, almost always, we will deposit either the bonds, the notes, or the paper with custodians, and the custodians hold them on behalf of the parties concerned. The owners will almost never actually ever see the real bonds, never see them. Usually they're simply deposited directly even before they're issued. They become available on the closing, but just before that they'll be deposited either just before or just after the closing. And then there's some additional points I'll make with regards to what we call global notes, temporary global notes. We have to understand how all of the parties and the main document operate. I've mentioned these temporary global notes. These are short-dated instruments, but what will happen is this. When it comes to the actual closing itself, we will not usually have all of the specific bonds printed and made available because they have to be security processed. So generally what will happen is we'll have a temporary global bond, a TGB, which will be made available on the closing, and then within 40 days we will produce all the definitive notes. There's a specific, almost accidental, point of market practice which arises here, which creates in practice a 40-day lockdown. There's a 40-day lockdown on most Eurobond issues. Why? Because under the Tax Equity and Fiscal Responsibility Act 1982 in America, the TEFRA, the issuer and the managers have to confirm to the US authorities whether any American citizens are going to own these bonds. The American authorities have very substantial reservations with regards to bearer markets. They want everything registered for publicity purposes, mainly for taxation, as well as for financial crime, anti-money laundering, counter-terrorist financing purposes. So they want confirmation of American ownership. In practice, very often what will happen is we will have legends, we will have sales restrictions on the bonds, which means they cannot be purchased by an American citizen anywhere in the world. Because if they can be purchased by an American citizen anywhere in the world, that creates extraterritorial reach and application of American securities law, the Securities Act 1933 and the Securities Act 1934. We either use one of the exemptions available under the Act, and I'll give you separate notes and outlines on this, or we simply disapply the sale of the bonds to an American citizen, because then there's no risk of breaching American law. Because we need to confirm whether any American citizens have acquired the bonds within that 40-day lockdown period under TEFRA, in practice this is used to allow for a period in which we can prepare all of the fully printed definitive bonds, and then those will be made available after the 40-day lockdown period. Now, what I was mentioning was this. It's the conditions with regards to these notes. They're generally short-dated, bearer, unsecured, negotiable, deposited, so they're deposited with a custodian. The two main custodians we use in this area are called Euroclear and Clearstream. Euroclear is based in Brussels, Euroclear, Brussels. Clearstream is in Luxembourg. Clearstream was originally set up as Cedel, C-E-D-E-L. These are the two primary custodians. Because the main market is in London, based in London, run out of London, we wanted to create custodians to operate in this market, so they wanted them to be outside London, but in an available, easy-to-access jurisdiction, so they picked Brussels and Luxembourg. Almost all euro bonds are deposited with these two custodians in practice. All transactions, in terms of secondary buying and selling of bonds, will then be conducted on the accounts of Euroclear and Clearstream. There's also a technical bridge between Euroclear and Clearstream with a fibre optic cable, which means that anything that's held by Euroclear and Clearstream, you can buy and sell across the accounts of the members of Euroclear and Clearstream. In practice, what that means is this. If you want to buy and sell Eurobonds, you deal with a commercial bank or an investment bank that has an account with one of these, and then you can just simply buy and sell that way. If your own bank is not a member, it will trade through a bank that is a member. It will simply appoint an agent who's already got an account with those. Almost all Eurobond dealing will be done through the accounts of Euroclear and Clearstream on this market. So they will be deposited. But all promissory notes, the three key financial instruments are the bill of exchange, the promissory note, and the cheque. And the cheque is simply a bill of exchange drawn in a bank, as defined under the Bills of Exchange Act 1882. All of this market is basically, technically, based on promissory notes. The same as a bank note. Bank notes are promissory note. It's a promise by the king or the queen, the state, to pay the bearer of the note the full value. Bonds are almost effectively the same as bank notes to that extent. So short-dated, bearer, unsecured, negotiable, deposited, promissory notes. They may be listed or they may be unlisted. Very often, you will want to have the bonds listed for marketability, for reputational purposes, as well as to create a market to the extent that the large insurance companies, pension funds, other asset managers across the world, they have what we call composition rules, they have portfolio rules. They will invest so much in listed stock, unlisted stock, higher list assets, foreign exchange, hedge funds, all sorts of, there's a whole series of asset classes that we define. Because they will have a proportion that they can invest on listed markets and unlisted markets, usually you want to list euro bonds so that you can sell them to the largest insurance companies, pension funds, reinsurance companies in the world. You may not need them listed, you may not actually transact on the stock market where they're listed, because all the secondary dealings will be done on Euroclear and Clearstream, but you still have them listed because it opens up the market so that these professional asset holders, they can come in and purchase them. Again, that then means you can sell more at lower cost. They may be committed or uncommitted. We've already mentioned this. The difference between a commercial paper program, for example, and a euro note program is a euro note would be committed. The banks have to purchase it. The commercial paper would be uncommitted, so that the government or the company would be taking a risk as to whether the market would actually acquire the instruments in practice. A number of other terms are often used then in practice. We talk about immobilization. The practice that we just described is immobilization. We deliver the temporary global bond, the TGB, on the closing, and then we replace that with the definitive notes within 40 days, but they're going to be deposited with Euroclear and Clearstream. They are immobilized. They don't enter the market openly, freely. They're basically held in deposit for the life of the duration of the bond. If it's a 20-year bond, it probably will never leave Euroclear and Clearstream. It's simply bought and sold across the accounts of Euroclear and Clearstream. We call that immobilization. More recent issues, however, are done in an electronic format, so we call that dematerialization. We don't even issue them now in a paper format with a temporary global and then a proper certificate being produced. They'll just be issued electronically. But again, they'll only be held in the accounts of Euroclear and Clearstream. We also have disintermediation. Disintermediation refers to the practice of setting up what we call a note issuance facility, an NIF, or a note issuance program, an NIP. That's for the shorter, 5 years, less than five, down to certainly commercial paper, anything from 5 days up to 365 days. We don't want to go back to the investment bank every time we want to raise funds, so we set up a program. The program may be committed or uncommitted, but this is a form of disintermediation. Because we have the program in place, the company or the government doesn't have to go back every time it wants to raise funds. It simply just issues the paper into the market itself, or the short notes, the euro notes. So it's disintermediated. So we have immobilization, dematerialization, disintermediation. There's two other technical terms which come up that are at the beginning of my chapter, so I'll just mention them now. We have demutualization and we have consolidation. What's actually happened is that in practice you have admission to listing and you have admission to trading. If you want the bonds to be sold and dealt with on a particular stock market or exchange, the New York Stock Exchange, the London Stock Exchange, what you will do is you'll have it listed, which means it can be sold to the general public. So we have listing satisfies a series of conditions imposed under almost all laws around the world to be sold to the general public. But secondly, you also want it to be admitted to trading, which is on a particular stock market and exchange. So you then have to satisfy the rules of the particular stock market and exchange. But what's actually happened over time is many of the largest stock markets in the world, they were just private associations. They were basically just clubs, gentlemen's clubs, owned by the people who ran the market. What happened was they demutualized. So they became public limited companies, and then they listed their own shares on their own markets. This is exactly what happened in New York. In New York with a big bang in 1975, and then we had a big bang in London, I think it was 83, 84, 85. So what effectively happened is the London Stock Exchange demutualized. Instead of being a private members association, it turned itself into a public limited company. It sold its shares to the public and then it listed those shares back in its own markets. So that's demutualization. The subsequent history of stock markets and exchanges has then been one of consolidation. They're all coming together, they're all taking over each other, they're all becoming part of larger and larger groups. I have a separate book on financial services law and then financial markets and exchanges law, and I trace the history and development of all of these connections between all of the biggest stock markets and exchanges in the world. So we have immobilization, dematerialization, disintermediation, demutualization and consolidation with regards to these new short instruments, and it's short-dated beta, unsecured, negotiable, deposited, promissory notes, which are either committed or uncommitted. In terms of the other parties then that form part of these more complex capital market transactions. So we have the same borrower. So the borrower is the company or government before, now wants to raise the same amount of money, in our example, 100 million. So this time, instead of entering into the loan agreement, they're going to issue bonds into the market directly or shorter notes or very short commercial paper up to 1 year. So we have the issuer. That could be a corporate, sovereign, government, or international financial institution. Again, we have a lead or arranging bank. The lead or arranging bank takes a mandate, authority, to set up the facility, enter into transactions, negotiate the documentation, and then raise the funds on behalf of the issuer. We're going to have private and public investors who will be purchasing the bonds, in this case, from the issuer. How do we manage the sale? If it's a large public issue, we will have to sell large volume of bonds by the leader arranging bank on behalf of the issuer to the general public. We'll then have two groups. We have an underwriting group and we have a selling group. The sales group, the selling group, are going to actually sell the bonds to the public. If they cannot sell all of the bonds and there's a shortfall, we then need underwriters to pick up that shortfall. And if it's a large public issue, we'll have more than one underwriter, so therefore we'll have an underwriting syndicate and a separate managing underwriter or managing underwriters group. So we have the selling group, we have the underwriters, and then we have the lead bank or arranging bank, and then we have the issuer, selling the bonds directly to the public in this case. Okay. We will also, if it's a large issue, we'll have a trustee. In this case, the trustee is acting on behalf of the investor, so there'll be a trustee with a trust deed. We also need an agent bank, so we're either going to have a paying agent or a fiscal agent. If there's a trust deed with a trustee, we only need a paying agent. If there's no trustee, we need a fiscal agent, because any funds held by the agent have to be held on trust on behalf of the investors. We'll create a trust if there's a trust deed with a trustee, but if there's no trustee, we need a separate trust, so we have a fiscal agent who also act effectively as a form of trustee, or it will at least at minimum hold any payments received in trust on behalf of the investors. So again, if there is a trustee with a trust deed, we only need an administrative paying agent. If there's no trustee, no trust deed, we need a fiscal agent, which creates a separate trust to hold interest on behalf of the investors. So we have a large number of additional parties, so therefore we need more documents. So we'll have the subscription agreements entered into between the issuer and the lead bank to confirm that they will ensure that the bonds are sold into the market and all of the bonds will be purchased. We'll have the trustee, we'll have the syndication, we have a underwriting agreement, we have a selling agreement, the syndication is the syndication agreement for the underwriting, and then we'll have the custodians, Euroclear, possibly a separate managing agreement as well if there's a number of managers concerned. That's the basic shape, structure, operation of a capital market deal. In terms of the timetable, how do we bring the bonds to market in practice? There's three main models. We can have what we call impact day offerings. We can have prospectus, preliminary prospectus offerings, which are called red herrings or pathfinders, and then we can have private placements. A typical Eurobond is number two. It's a preliminary prospectus offering. We're going to prepare a prospectus which provides all of the information about the offering, about the issuing company, about the business, and about how all of the payments that are going to be made will be funded through the development of the issuer's business. It corresponds with the information memorandum in the loan deal, except this will be even more detailed, even more substantial. If we're going to list, the prospectus becomes the listing particulars as well. But what will happen is, in a typical Euro bond deal, a US domestic or a Canadian domestic will have a red herring or a pathfinder prospectus. We prepare the prospectus, the lead bank then shows it to some parties in the market to get a feel for the market. What we're trying to say is this: the two key things we need to deal with are it's the coupon and the price. What's the price of the bonds and what's the coupon? We need to know what the interest is and we need to know what we're selling the bonds for. Are we selling them at par? Are we selling them at a discount, which is cheaper? Or are we selling them at a premium, which is more? We need to get a feel for the market. So at any point in time, You're always looking at this. Same thing happens with share issues as well as bonds and other any form of security issues. You can issue at par, discount, or premium, and then what you simply do is you will adjust the coupon to reflect that as well. These are the two big decisions we have to take. What's the interest? What do we have to pay on the coupon to get interest? And then are we going to pay par, premium, or discount? You also specifically get what are called deep discounts. A deep discount security or a deep discount bond is when there's a substantial discount in the price, possibly 30%. So $100 million of bonds, you're going to sell at $70 million. Why would you do that? Because what you effectively do is this, you roll the coupon into the price. You don't pay any interest, and when you redeem in, say, 5 years, you redeem at par value. So what you've effectively done is rolled up all the interest, and you've paid that off as a discount at the beginning. And then all of that is then covered because it's redeemed in full at the end. This is very useful for tax purposes for particular types of investors. And very often, these sort of large pension funds, insurance companies, they're long term. They're not thinking 5 years. They're thinking 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years ahead. They're not looking for short interest payments. This is very attractive in practice, deep discount bonds. So you don't pay any interest, there's no coupon. What you do is you roll all of that up and you make it available in the form of a discount on the price up front. If you think the market's going to grow quickly, you'll sell at a premium, even higher. But if you have a high premium, you'll have a lower coupon. And you just adjust the two. Those are the two main things we need to price effectively, the coupon and the initial price. We can do that through a red herring or a pathfinder. This is the most common way dealing with bond issues in the Eurobond deal. But again, all of this is happening quickly. We can also have, for a UK domestic or a large UK public offering, like as a privatisation, for example, we have an impact day offering. The investment firm, the investment bank, decides the price, the coupon. There's a public announcement, and then the general public will have a certain period within which they can subscribe. Slightly more risky, but if they get it right, they can make even more money. But again, your investment bank should know this anyway. They're in the market all day, every day. They should know what the market's doing. They should be able to form an opinion on this almost immediately. You also have what are called private placements. Private placements, the managers are going to subscribe, undertake to take the whole issue on under the subscription agreement, and then just sell them on. Because again, that's what investment firms do. That's what an investment bank is. It has a whole stack of clients all ready to buy this stuff. If it's not a particularly large issue, 20, 30, 40 million, it'll just buy it up itself, put it on its own books, and just sell it out to its clients. So private placement. That's much cheaper then because you don't have all of these other parties. We don't need selling groups, we don't need underwriters, and the investment bank gets all of the fees itself directly. In practice then, we have what we call a bought deal. That's the most common format, a bought deal. The managers, there's no preliminary prospectus, the managers just commit to undertaking everything, buying it all up, put it on their own books, and then just selling on. Hopefully they won't even have to put it on their own books, but they will take on the responsibility. And then they just sell to some. So those are the three main forms. Preliminary prospectus offering, the most common form in the Eurobond market. UK domestics are impact days, and we can also have a lot of common private placements, which we can also refer to as a bought deal. In terms of the timetable itself, this generally happens over a 30-day, a 20-day period. It's like a week. It's 4 weeks. It's a month. You've got the initial marketing. Either the company is going to approach or the government will approach the investment bank. In practice, the investment banks are basically always trying to get business from the largest companies in the world and the government. So they're always pressing. We're ready, we're available. What would you like to do this week or this month? Are you ready to do something new? We're ready to act for you. If necessary, there will be, for example, like presentations. And the investment bank will go around, basically sell the services, explain all the things they're offering. Usually everybody knows everybody else, so that's most often not required. So either the client will approach the investment bank, or much more commonly the investment banks already have contact with the clients. We're going to have a pre-launch, so that's D-Day minus 7. D-Day is the launch date. That's when this goes public. That's when it's formally announced to the markets. So D-Day minus 7, we take the mandate letter, carry out initial due diligence, and begin to think about what we're doing, begin to think about the documentation that we need. On D-Day, we have the formal announcement to the public that the market is basically open there. That we're, this is coming, and this is going to come within 21 days, within 3 weeks. So we have D-Day, 2 weeks, D-Day plus 14, D-Day plus 21. Now what happens specifically in practice is this, we get the beginning of a grey market. As soon as we've made it public that these bonds are coming to the market, you've already of itself created a market in those bonds. So this is called the grey market. They've not even been launched, created yet. They won't be made available for how long? 3 weeks plus the 40 days. So you can't actually buy them for 3 weeks plus 40 days. But still, you'll have a grey market forming in these. The market's already pricing them. It knows it's coming them. Is it going to go up or down? Is it going to be discount premium or whatever? And we'll come back and talk about this later. We have what we call stabilization rules. Normally, the manager, the lead managers, cannot manage the price. But in practice, they're going to do that. Because what will happen is people will be short-selling these. That's going to push the price down. So the managers want a good, safe, stable issue, so they're going to try and push the price back up. So the managers are allowed to go into the market and manipulate the market. That's legally. That's called stabilization. A specific set of rules which allows the managers to intervene to support the price during the grey market period. Because the managers want to make sure we get a good closing, we get a good price when we bring these to market eventually. So, syndication. Launch with the syndication as we bring all the parties together, including, if necessary, an underwriting group and a sales group. All of this will be set out initially in the invitation telex. This is the same as the term sheet that we have in the loan deal. It's basically like a mini loan agreement. All of the core terms are set out in this term sheet. It basically takes the index from the loan agreement and just has a lot of kind of summary clauses. It's a summary document. We use the same thing in a capital market deal, except this time it becomes the invitation telex. So all the core terms outlined will be put in this. Everything apart from possibly the coupon and the price. Certainly, if it's a PAF, a preliminary, if it's a Eurobond deal, if it's a domestic, coupon and price will be in the invitation telex as well. So you summarise everything. We're going to prepare the preliminary offering circular, which is basically the information memorandum, the prospectus, which again, if we're going to list, will become the listing particulars. This has to be prepared in accordance with a series of key rules which are set out in all legal systems. So we have the listing rules, we have the transparency rules, and we have the disclosure rules. All of this are on the Financial Conduct Authority website in the UK. There's EU directives and regulations on all of this. The UK had all of this in place anyway, and to a large extent, a lot of the UK provisions simply reflect what was already the UK practice. The European Union is still trying to build a capital market, a single capital market. It's still not working. They just haven't got the liquidity and the volumes in the market to make this work yet. So the main capital market in Europe is still London. So, invitation telex with the preliminary offering circular. All of this will still be subject to contract. We have a presumption that when you're entering into negotiations, you're preparing documentation, there is an assumption that this is intended to have legal effect. So we need to reverse that presumption so everything is subject to contract. There's a number of cases in this area. I refer to them both in my bond chapter and in my loan chapter. Key cases, Pagnum SPA versus Feed Products 1987, Lloyd's Rep 601. We'll also have a separate allotment telex. The allotment telex specify how much the selling group are going to get each. Because this is what's going to control the market. Because what will happen is this, the selling group are not sure how much they're going to receive. So again, if they short sell or they try to sell what they don't know whether they get or not, that can cause a lot of problems with the pricing and with the offering and with the issues. That's why the specific rules in the ICMA, International Capital Market Association, handbook for this, and what we try to do is this. We try to have a provisional allotment of the bonds as to who's going to receive how much the day after D-Day. So we try to send the allotment telex out the day after, if we can. And what we try to do is, this is another rule, it basically says that allotment should at least be no less than 50%. So the sales group should at least get 50% of what they were expecting. But this is again where it quite can cause problems, because if the selling group don't get all they're expecting, if they've already kind of sold on or promised to sell on, that's why you can have these problems, and that's why we also have the stabilisation. So 2 weeks later, we'll have the signing. We're going to sign all the main documents. The key one is the subscription agreement between the managing group, the lead managers, and the issuing company or government to undertake to bring the bonds to the market. We'll be offering circular, then the auditor's comfort letter, and then any other key documents we're going to have negotiated, and we'll have at a good stage, hopefully ready for signing. If they're not signed on the D-Day plus 14, on the signing day, we're going to sign at the closing. We can leave some things towards the end, but we'll try to get as much as we can done by D-Day plus 14. We then have the closing itself. The closing is usually 1 week after the subscription agreement is signed. So that's D-Day minus 7, D-Day 14, 21. So a 4 week period, 30 day period. So we're going to hand over, deliver the manager's agreement with the agency agreement or the fiscal and paying agency agreement. If there's a trustee, it's only an agency agreement, paying agency agreement. If there's no trustee, we need a fiscal agreement. Underwriting agreement, any conditions precedent have to be satisfied. This will include, again, for example, specimen signatures for parties to sign documents, as well as board resolutions, copy memorandum, articles. All of that will be delivered if it hasn't been delivered already. The closing letter, trustee. If there's any separate guarantees, may or may not apply in practice. If we're applying for listing, we'll bring the listing forward, and then the funds will actually be transferred. The funds will be paid. What's going to happen is the purchasers, the subscribers, they're going to pay the money into the manager's account, and on the same day, the manager's going to pay from their account to the issuer. So the issuer gets the 100 million. And because of the selling arrangements and because of the underwriting specifically, the issuer is going to get a full 100 million, less fees and charges. But it's going to get all of it, because that's the whole point, having the underwriting in place. As we said already, there'll be a temporary global bond. We don't deliver all of the definitive notes of bonds, because they take time to prepare. We've started here. This is 4 weeks later. There may or may not be time, but that doesn't matter. We've got an extra 40 days because of the TEFRA lockdown. So we can prepare all the definitive hard copy bonds. But again, there'll be boxes and boxes of these, but no one ever sees them. Why? Because they go straight to Euroclear and Clearstream. They're just simply immobilised. Or will now be dematerialised. The TGB itself is referred to, is described as sui generis. There is nothing else quite like it. Because what does it represent? That one single TGB, if it was a paper one, it would be like this. It would look like this for 100 million. It's a single sole note or bond which represents the whole of the issuance on behalf of everybody. So all of the sub-bonds are all integrated, consolidated, aggregated into one. And who owns this? Who holds this? Euroclear or Clearstream? Completely unusual. There's almost like nothing else. So it's called sui generis, because it's completely unusual in law. Is this a negotiable instrument? Probably not. Almost certainly not. It only lasts for 40 days till we get the definitive notes to replace temporary global under the TEFRA rules. All of the other detail is developed further in the chapter. This includes the historical background to these markets. The earliest origin, the beginning of all of this, was, for example, the Monte Comune in Florence, which was basically an early form of annuity. Public states would start to issue bonds into the market, with the bond payments, the interest payments, being tied to tax receipts from the general public. This is the beginning of public borrowing in the 1300s, with the Monte Comune in Florence, and then Vienna and elsewhere. The background to the rest of the development of the market is already here, from early East India Company issuances, I've already shown you an early East India Company bond, to the later development of the British bond market, in particular with annuities. You'll see there the 3% bank annuities, 1726, and then the 3% consols, 1751. This is how governments funded their activities for hundreds of years, through the bond market, and they still do. This is why this is arguably one of the largest and probably the most important market in the world, because this is where all the governments and companies get their money to carry on all of their activities and all other aspects of all other countries and all other markets that they're involved with. I also explained the background to the gold standard, and then post-war period, collapse of the gold standard, with Bretton Woods after the Second World War, 1944, which established the fixed monetary arrangement system. Is technically, it's what we call a gold exchange standard. Instead of fixing the value of gold to sterling, we would fix the value of gold to dollar, and then every other country in the world was fixed to dollar at an adjustable exchange rate mechanism. All of this collapses beginning in August 1971. President Richard Nixon is on the radio, he's giving an address, a State of the Union address, and at the end of this, on 15th August 1971, he announces, "Oh, and we're going to close the gold window," which basically meant other countries, other governments could no longer send dollar bills to New York and have the Americans legally exchange them for gold bullion. That was how the system worked for 40 years. The American system came under too much pressure, simply because the economy was overheating, because of the Vietnam War, they didn't want to raise taxes excessively, so the American government decided we're going to suspend this. There was a committee of 20 appointed for 3 years to try and come up with a new solution. None of that worked. So from 1973-74, we've gone to floating interest rates. So we have massive new foreign exchange volatility for the first time in hundreds of years, apart from just before and after the First and Second World Wars. This is what creates the modern world. The early 1970s, all of the new interest rate volatility, and then all of the other consequential foreign exchange volatility and everything else that arose at this time. So, short summary of all of that's provided. We look at the basic bond structures, the key financials, amount, term, interest, payment. We then look at form, parties, documentation, any ancillary or additional provisions. The issuance procedure I outlined here, basically in terms of that 12-part kind of stage format I outlined before. We're going to take an initial mandate. That's the instructions from the borrowing company or government to proceed. We're going to conduct some early due diligence just to make sure everything's all right, there's no conflicts of interest, everything else is properly in place. Well then, this is the pre-launch period, D-Day minus 7. We'll then have the launch date. We're going to have the invitation telex, which will record all of the key terms, and then we'll try, and if we can, as soon as possible after that, make provisional allotments in the allotment telex. We're going to prepare all of the documentation, all of the key sets of papers I've referred to before. We agree all of the key terms. Depending upon whether it's going to be the red heading or the bond deals, or the other formats that we looked at before, the preliminary offering prospectus, the impact day offerings, or a private placement, will determine the price and the coupon. We have the signing, which is D-Day plus 14. We set up stabilisation, which begins technically from the D-Day initial announcement. We'll try to make the provisions of allotment, and I prefer to hear the additional provisions in the IPMA. That it was the International Primary Markets Association, but the International Primary Markets Association merged with the International Secondary Markets Association in 2005, so it's now the International Primary Markets Association. This actually began as the, I think it was the Association of Broker Dealers, Bond Dealers, back in 1968. The AIBD then becomes the International Secondary Markets Association in 1992, and then in 2005, the International Secondary Markets Association, which is the secondary market, buying and selling the bonds once they're issued, merges with the International Primary Markets Association, which is the one that brings the bonds to the market in the first place. They merge in 2005 to form the International Capital Markets Association. It's the principal key trade association in this area. It now has members from 62 countries, 600 members. We'll apply for listing if we want this to be made available for listing. We don't actually need to buy and sell on the particular stock market that we're applying for any listing to. Although, as I've said before, there's two things. Admission to listing is to sell to the general public, and then admission to trading is on a particular stock market exchange. We want to get listing simply because it opens the market for the large insurance companies, pension funds around the world to purchase, so we can borrow, we can issue more at a cheaper coupon. And then we have the closing. So all the key stages are explained here. When the definitive bonds are going to follow 40 days after the lockdown period in the TEFRA, which is mentioned there, this is the lockdown TEFRA, and then we're going to replace them with the global bonds and securities. All of this will be immobilized anyway. It's all simply transferred to Euroclear and Clearstream, and now, as we've said already, very often it'll be dematerialized. And if it's short dated, it's going to be disintermediated, because we set things up in the form of a note issuance facility or a note issuance program. Bond negotiability, this depends on the market recognition. This was provided for in a series of important cases under English law: Picker versus London and County Banking, Buchanan Land Exploration, Lord Esher, Bowen LG, and then the famous case Edelstein versus Schuler. It's if the market recognises it as being negotiable, then the courts will accept that market recognition. This is part of what we call a form of lex mercatoria. The merchants set their own laws, develop their own laws, the courts simply recognise market practice. It essentially goes to the volume and frequency. That's the key test. You'll see in the cases, for example, there was Edelstein versus Schuler, Bingham G. In my opinion, the time has passed when negotiability of bearer bonds, whether government bonds or trading bonds, foreign or English, can be called in question in our courts. Existence of their usage has been so often proved, and its convenience is so obvious that it must be taken down to be part of the law. What had happened was Prussian stock was negotiable in the country of issuance in Prussia, but in Germany, but not in London, so therefore it wasn't considered to be negotiable. So there's some interesting issues on negotiability. It again means because this is a bearer market, we can transfer the bonds by delivery. I also discussed in the text the governing law issues that arise with regards to determining which law will apply, and then jurisdictions to hear disputes. Bond clearing, this is a temporary global bond which will be deposited with Euroclear and Clearstream. Clearstream was originally SEDEC. So the unique nature of the TGB is all discussed in here with Euroclear and Clearstream's involvement. The bond structure, this is just different types of instruments in practice. So we have the Euro bond market. The basic bonds are called plain vanillas. But then there's various different types of bonds we can have within this. So we can have zero coupon bonds, we can have foreign currency bonds, we can have reverse dual currency bonds, we can have first coupon or partly paid bonds, or we can have currency change bonds or annuity bonds. These are all just specific types of options. The key point to make here simply is this. In the loan market, we have an enormous amount of flexibility which we can incorporate into the terms of the loan agreement, the loan documentation. We cannot do that in the capital market area. When something's brought to the market, it's fixed, essentially. So what we have to do is we have to pre-design all of the options that we might have under a loan deal. We pre-designing the capital market deal, and that's why they got all these different names. And a lot of it's very straightforward. Most of it is just moving interest rates or caps at various forms. A lot of it's tied to the financials. But we need to pre-design. The functionality, the flexibility, the optionality, all has to be pre-designed into all these variety of different types of bonds, notes and paper programs we bring to the market. Because we don't have the same flexibility as we have under a single loan agreement. So, for the plain vanillas, we can, there's the zero coupons. So large, substantial discount, possibly 30%. What we do is we don't pay coupon, we don't pay interest, we just roll it up and we sell it at a discount first. So that's how you get your interest instead. That's effectively 30%. If it was a 30% discount, that's 30% interest over the duration of the loan, which might be five, the issuance, which might be five, 10 or 15 years, up to 20 years. Then we have the FRNs. This begins at the beginning of the 1970s, after the collapse of the Bretton Woods system, so we have floating rate notes. We go from fixed bonds, fixed interest, to floating rates. So with different types of floating rates, basically it's how we calculate the interest. Do we have a floor level? Do we have an upper level? Do we have a collar, upper and lower? So we have floor FRNs, we have drop locks, we have double drop locks, caps, collars, inverses. FRNs, bill reverses, minimaxes. There's just all sorts of different types of variations on the possible types of clause we could have. We can have step downs, step ups, margins, floating rates. Most of this is just tied to the interest rate and how we calculate it. Because of all the flexibility we have in a loan deal, we lose all that when we go to the capital markets. So we need to pre-design that. So we can have bunnies, multiplier bonds, we can have lobos, and we can have bolos. Lenders option, borrower, borrowers option, lender option. And then we can have graduated rate bonds, deferred coupons, profit sharing, index, and duets. All the different types of bonds. And again, when I was doing this, this was all the stuff I could find in the market. It was actually very interesting. It would be very interesting just to see what we have now. What are the newer types of instruments available now as well? So what we can have as well, we can have perpetuals, which means they last forever, unless there's a default, or usually a default or a withholding. But you can have perpetuals. It's common at government level, it's not common for companies. Companies don't like perpetuals. They don't tend to issue them. But there's a whole series of different options again. So we can have perpetuals, put options, put in calls, extendables, retractables, step-ups, sinking funds, purchase funds. This is to do with exchangeability as well as repayment. There's different types of repayment. Under the loan agreement, you can draw down with maximum flexibility over the commitment period, possibly once every month for up to 2 years, with an issuance, a note, a bond, and a paper program is virtually almost always on the front dates. You just draw all down in one go at the beginning. Occasionally, it's two issuances at the beginning. With the floating rate notes, then it's when the issuers come into the market each time. But you've then got a lot more flexibility on the bond deal. The same thing happens with the repayment. With the loans, we can have a whole series of options. We need to try and define those into the bond systems, so there's different ways of getting a redemption. What can happen is it can all be redeemed at once, or we can redeem in staged periods, so the issuer is cancelling certain amounts of bonds after 5 years or maybe after 10. And then you also have something called a purchase fund, where the issuer sets up a separate purchase fund with a broker, and the broker is then going to buy bonds from the market, which is essentially a form of redemption. So you can sell your bonds to the broker as part of a purchase fund. It's an early form of redeeming. A lot of people like it, and they want to do that. So there's just lots of different options, but because of the fixed nature of capital market deals, we need to design all this up front, and then we need to give it a name. That's why we have all of these different types of forms and formats. So there's the redemption there. So we can redeem them. So we have bullet bonds, we can have annuities, we can have foreign currencies, dual currencies, heaven and hell bonds, capped heaven and hell stuff. We can also have reverse heaven hells, bull bears, index links, commodities, S&P's links, flip flops, whole series of stuff. Now, we also then have warrants. A warrant entitles you to buy more of the same thing. So if you want to make the initial bond note paper attractive, you attach a warrant to it, because then people will like to buy them, because they can either exercise the warrant or they can sell the warrant on separately. It's effectively another security. It's like a double security. So a lot of people like warrants. It's a very useful way to make your initial offering go well. But then there's different types of warrants. So you can have putables, redeemables, nakeds, covereds, options, and commodities. Then again, we can have equity-linked bonds, and then we're into the medium-term note program. So I deal with the medium-term notes in the historical chapter, structural chapter, and then again in the bond chapter. These are unsecured debt instruments, 9 months up to 15 years, so typically 5 to 10 is the most common MTNs. It's the middle of the market. It basically followed American practice, so we had the American market jump from the big long bonds way down to the short bonds, then back up to the MTNs. All that's happened is in my chapter, it seemed better here, so I put it in here. Historically, we went from long bonds down to short euro notes, commercial paper, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 years, then back up to the medium term notes. But it works better to talk about long bonds down to medium term notes down to short euro notes. So I explain all the background to this. This is the origin of the market, early growth, different types of MTNs. Then the euro notes themselves. So the euro notes are just shorter again than the MTNs, although historically with the euro notes, then the MTNs followed. Then different, so all of this will be issued under a note issuance facility, the NIF. Then you get different types of facilities. So we have a RUF, there's a revolving underwriting facility. We have a GUN, grantor underwritten note, which is different types of facilities there. We have coats, coins, and mittens. Then we have commercial paper. This is up to 1 year. What's the difference between the euro note and the commercial paper? We've said before, it's more formal. So the commercial paper is not underwritten. It can be issued in hours rather than days. Maturities can be anything from 7 to 365 days. Settlement will be shorter rather than 7 days for the euro notes. And then it'll be shorter, smaller denominations. So shorter duration, smaller denominations again. Certificates of deposit, I covered in the historical development class, and I gave you a map of all the markets in the world. Then the multi-option facility with the different types of possible options in the facility. So a MOF could include short-term advances, swing-line facilities, commercial paper or euro commercial paper, bankers' acceptances, and then the main one's the MTN. The key thing's the MTN. And then you just build additional flexibility around that. And then we have the domestics. So we have the countries, the national stuff, and the domestics. So bond structures and corporate bonds, UK gilts, stocks and bonds, UK gilt edge securities, local authority stocks, public sector bonds. Then we have United States Treasury Agency municipal bonds, US Federal Agency securities, municipal bonds, and then we have the Japanese. Sometimes these are called samurai bonds. Then we have the Germans, the Bundesobligationen, all these other separate different types of facilities, whether it's the government or a public authority or the local authorities. That's the Pfandbriefe market, that's the mortgage bond market. A whole series of different things which support borrowing in Germany. This is how the German finance system works. This is the key part. It's all based on this market here. Other government securities, then corporate bonds. UK debentures and loan stock, US corporate bonds, Japanese bond market, foreign bonds, other bond variants. We can understand all of this just by considering this both from the euro dollar, international bond market, either the companies, biggest companies in the world, or the governments, and then down to the domestics, with either the government borrowing or the corporates. This is one of the most interesting, exciting, significant, fast-changing markets in the world. It's an excellent area of law to become involved in.